Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. On today's show, I talk with Jeff Crowther, Executive Director of the Health Products Association China, or HPA China. Jeff shares his insights into the dynamic world of dietary supplements and nutritional ingredients in China, providing a deeper understanding of the market's growth, consumer trends, and regulatory landscape. Jeff begins by recounting his journey from the U.S. to China, detailing how his passion for studying China and health products turned into a career that led him to his current role at HPA China. He discusses the mission of HPA China and its efforts to foster the growth of the health products industry within the region. The discussion moves to an overview of China's natural health products market, highlighting why it is one of the fastest growing sectors. Jeff identifies key consumer trends, such as increasing health awareness and the rising demand for natural and safe supplements, which are driving the market. Jeff also addresses the regulatory challenges that foreign brands face when entering the Chinese market and offers valuable insights into leveraging cross-border e-commerce as an effective market entry strategy. This channel allows international brands to bypass many traditional regulatory hurdles, making it an attractive option for new entrants. Enjoy.
The size of the market, I don't think anyone really knows. We have various sources to get this information, but some of it is the Chinese government that controls all the imports and exports. They have numbers. There's a Chinese healthcare association. They have their numbers. You look at Euromonitor or any of the other big multinational companies that track sales and marketing around the world. They have their numbers, and they're skewed by billions of dollars. I mean, they're just not even close. The U.S. market, I think it's approaching or in the $60 billion range, and China's number two. So U.S. is the biggest market for supplements in the world, and China has grown to the point where it became number two. And that's considering that it's not even, I mean, it hasn't even put a dent in the potential of what China could be.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Jeff, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Hello, Todd. How's it going?
It's going very well. Thanks for coming on the show today. Now, let's start. Where are you in the world that we're recording you from today?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I'm here in cool Austin, Texas. It's actually quite cool here today.
Well, we are early December. Is it unusual for it to be cool in Austin in early December?
Yeah, January, February, the colder months. And last night we got a warning for a possible freeze, but it went down to 35, I believe. It didn't get quite down there that low, but I think we're in our 60s or so right now. So that's not too
bad. Okay. Yeah, here in Canada, we definitely do not get warnings when it's freeze.
It's expected.
It's pretty standard. Yeah.
I think Ice Age would be the warning for you guys if that was coming.
That's all we need to know. Is there a glacier coming? You know, That's all we need to know about. Tell us a little bit about your career journey, because, you know, we're always interested to know how people ended up working in China, especially in your case, working in the health products industry and how that all eventually brought you to China.
Yeah, that's, I think, an interesting story on my part. And it's just something that people usually end up in China, like after college, they go teach English. Or they get a job with a big company that's a multinational, and they get actually sent over to Asia as part of a team, or they're in the government. Those are kind of the three big ones when you meet people in China and say, hey, how'd you end up here? You know, and then they start telling you.
100%.
So I had it in my mind I wanted to go to China because I knew China was up and coming and it would be a great place for business. And what I did is I just kind of pulled that desire and my degree in school. So my college was Asian Pacific Studies with business, and we had to choose either Japan, China, or Korea as a focus. And I chose China. And then I partnered that with the fact that I had been working in the health food, dietary supplement industry for many years already, like part-time and you know, doing it as to support my career as a student. So my mission was, I know it was easy to get to China, be an English teacher, and I had a friend at an English school there. So if that was my way in, that's what I was going to do. But that's not what happened. And I didn't want to do that because I didn't really enjoy teaching English that much. I was working one day at the vitamin store, and the president of the company, and this is a multi-billion dollar company at that time, it was a very big company that owned Vitamin World where I worked, which is kind of like a GNC. They don't exist anymore, but he came into the store and we started chatting, and he asked me, you know, what I was going to school for and all these things. And he said, well, we're thinking about China. We do a lot of business there. And that's very interesting. And we left it at that. And I got a call 2 months later and said, we want to fly you to New York to the headquarters and talk about China. And I said, okay. And they offered me the position of business development manager and country representative for the company to go over there and open their first office in China. So that's how I ended up in China. I was working for this company called NBTY that they own many different brands like Nature's Bounty and Solgar and a variety of different brands. But that's how I ended up there as a business person going over there, opening an office and, you know, doing all that stuff.
Okay. What circa what timeline, what year was this about?
So that was, my first time in Greater China politically would be Taiwan, and that was in 2000, and I was there for 3 months. But for MBTY, that was, and then I went to mainland China in 2004 to visit my friend for 3 months and just hang out. And then as a business person getting that job, that was 2005 that I was sent to Beijing, and I lived in Beijing for 9 years as part of my stay. And I moved around after that. And so I had a total of 14 plus years in China.
Those early days, those early conversations in New York, and they're looking to put somebody on the ground in China. The decision gets made to choose Beijing. Can you tell us a little bit about the how and why of that decision?
Well, at that point, almost every large company had to have some kind of China plan. And in the case of supplement industry, the amount of raw materials and ingredients that are manufactured in China is huge. It's anywhere from 70 to 80% of all vitamin ingredients and botanicals, extracts, all that stuff comes from China. So the industry already had a very big partnership in terms of how the global situation of the industry went. But most of the supplement companies didn't have offices in China or even have their products in China because it wasn't the supplement industry wasn't really developed at that point. So MBTY at that time, again, was a multi-billion dollar company. So they were going to be the first to do this. And they wanted someone they could trust and someone that knew their corporate culture. And that was me. I had been working for them for quite a few years on a kind of assistant manager and like part-time basis, paying my way through college. And I also was studying Chinese. So for them, I was kind of a no-brainer to tap and see if this guy would fit what we want. And Beijing specifically was chosen because the first step into the market is all about regulatory. Everything else comes second, you know, marketing and all those other things. First is, you know, the regulatory situation in this country, wherever you're going, how does it work? How do we circumvent it? How do we follow the regulation? How do we make things happen? So Beijing, of course, is the hub of the government and the capital city. And that's where at that time it was the FDA, Chinese FDA, that kind of oversaw the industry of supplements in China. So I had to be, we had to open the office and be close to the regulators to kind of have meetings with them and kind of understand everything. And that, at that time, that's where a lot of the agents were located around that area as well. So companies that would help you register things and get things approved and importing, exporting, all that stuff. So that's how I ended up in Beijing.
Yes, it's certainly a lot easier. And I think because I have a similar timeline. I went to China in 2007, and I was dealing with, you know, my visa, my blue paper, my residency, getting a bank account. And even in those days, kind of mid 2000s, you were behooving yourself as far as ease and efficiency as a foreigner, as a foreign company, to be in, because what the audience needs to understand is that even though we could name a few dozen cities that are probably in the 1 to 5 million, 6 million person size, that they were not very developed in receiving and having foreigners or foreign companies. It was even very difficult for me, because I was in Dalian in 2008, 2009, to get things done as a foreigner. The systems, processes, knowledge, and understanding were still not super developed. So I think back in those days, even though that was, you know, we're talking less than 20 years ago, but still, being in a major city, despite China having 100 cities that are, you know, bigger than any city in Canada, you really had to kind of choose from the top five if you really wanted to have any ease of getting things done. So feel free to speak on that if you want.
Yeah. And I think the other decision that the CEO and VP and all that of the company, they wanted to be boots on the ground in China, because China is not transparent whatsoever, especially back then. Again, you just said it's less than 20 years, but I mean, it was such a different place back then, in terms of how things worked and operated. And there was no, I mean, I wish I, as a business development manager for China, for that company, I wish there was someone like me available to join and hire and get all the information I need about China, like within a phone call. All I had was Euromonitor at that time was the only company that had some information available. And of course, MBTU, I had a subscription, which was quite expensive back then, to Euromonitor to get some basic information, which ended up being not even close to being accurate at that time. I mean, no disrespect to them, but no one really had a handle on what was going on there. So they wanted boots on the ground. They wanted someone to, you know, go to these meetings, meet the people, go to the stores, go to the pharmacies, go to the points of sale, go, you know, talk to people that are doing, you know, direct sales and multi-level marketing. And, you know, how does all this stuff work? And what's the reality of the situation? Who are those companies that could potentially be partners of us as distributors in China? And how do we get our stuff on the shelf legally? All those things came into play. But it was so... I remember very clearly sitting in my office in New York, in Long Island, where the headquarters was, before I was there for 3 months in that headquarters before I actually went to China, and just preparing everything. And there was very, very little that I could do. There was no associations. There was no HPA China. There was no, you know, there was nothing to grab onto. So it was really, you know, boots on the ground for sure to get any of that information.
Starting from scratch.
And then as a person, like you had mentioned, just to touch on that, when you arrive, my goodness, you know, MBTY, I was kind of on an expat package. So they had gotten me an apartment, and I didn't know exactly where I was going to live till I got there. And I had a local handler to pick me up at the airport and bring me to my apartment. And then I was kind of left on my own. And then I had a BlackBerry, which was the, you know, businessman phone or business person phone at the time. And then I had a local cell phone just to make local calls. And so I was walking around with two huge kind of cell phones on me at all times. And then just, you know, navigate. And that's one thing I had to teach the company, MBTY, my boss, the VP of International. I had to teach him, you know, why are things going so slowly? You know, and I said, well, first of all, I had to go to the bank yesterday to pay for the electricity and internet for my apartment, and also go to the other bank to pay for the internet and get things going for the office that we're going to rent, this little office we had. And that was an all day thing. And they just couldn't believe it. You know, and I was like, well, here's, you know, you're standing in line And people would pay, I mean, people that live there would pay people to stand in line for them. And so you're constantly getting cut in front of by these people that are off doing whatever. And then they get closer to the front and they show up. And then you get a grandpa or grandma in front of you and then forget it. They've got their whole extended family's passbooks with them to go through every account and move money around and pay bills. They would sit in front of a teller for 30, 40 minutes. And it would just literally take all day. And then your electricity was on a card. I know you know all this stuff. You live there too, but you got to charge the card up at the bank, bring it home, stick it in the slot outside your apartment, charge up your electricity for the apartment. So it was a pay in advance system. And I can remember more than once waking up with the electricity had shut off in the middle of summer and I had forgotten to charge up the card. So there's all these little, you know, cultural differences. And what we were before we started recording, we were talking about the name of this show, The Negotiation, and it's, you know, doing cultural business. I mean, just all the things that you have to learn about and deal with to just make your day happen.
For those of you going over there now, you're welcome.
Much different. Yeah, because much different.
we were part of pioneering and building some of those processes that now are a lot easier. But yes, I could go on about the stories, even at an apartment I moved into that had 200 units in it. And they said, it comes with free internet, but the internet was so super slow, and it was provided by the apartment building. So I went down to China Unicom to actually put my own router and modem in my apartment. And they said, no, I was not allowed. I had to go talk to the building manager. And that was really confusing to me. Why can't you just, I'm willing to pay, just come in. And I had to pay off the building manager to then make a phone call to the people behind the desk at China Unicom to unlock my apartment account in their system to then allow a worker to come and install internet in my place, because he was taking full payment for what internet would cost for rent. But then he would, of course, only pay one internet to provide for the whole building, but charge 200 people the full price. And now 200 units are sharing one internet line amongst themselves, which is why it was so slow.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, very unique. I had a high appreciation for how innovatively entrepreneurial they were and the things that they could do. I mean, you really learn what it takes when you're there. And for those who don't know what I mean by blue paper, we expats refer to the blue paper. You go to the police station, and basically it's kind of a criminal check and a financial owing check. Make sure that nobody has put any liens on you as a person, that you owe them for something from some prior landlord or something like that. And you need that to then go to the office and extend your visa and this kind of thing. So the blue paper is basically the police giving you an okay, you're allowed to renew your visa type thing. Anyway, we digress. Let's talk about HPA China. Tell us about HPA China and tell us about your current role with them now.
Okay. So just as a timeline, I'll just finish up the MBTY story. Just
perfect,
because that's where the HPA comes into play to some degree. So I did that job for MBTY for a year, and I was based in Beijing. And after that, I had finished up all the market research and, you know, scrutinizing different partners and potential distributors, et cetera. And then the company hired a local Chinese businessman to be the China like CEO and kind of run the company. And it was at that point I was approached by another association called Natural Products Association, and they wanted to open an office in China. So I was already in China, and the chairman came over and met with me, and we talked. And so I opened up an office, and I did that job for 4 years. And I was a lobbying kind of position. So I was set up in the American Chamber of Commerce, and I was, you know, working very closely with the U.S. government and the Chinese government to encourage dietary supplement regulatory in a kind of more positive direction, to follow kind of what the U.S. is doing, so that we could have more U.S. companies obviously go to China and do business. That lasted 4 years. And then there was a lot of change at NPA, the association at the head office, not really into having an office or understanding what we're doing there. So I was in China full time. So I was never really coming back to the US. And so I think a lot of the board members kind of became disillusioned. Like, why are we there? What are we doing? And that kind of just fell apart and ended up closing the office. But I was left with all these US companies that were like, well, Jeff, we need help. And, you know, so that's where I said, well, I'll just look into this nonprofit situation. I did tons of work researching the IRS and all these things and how you set up a nonprofit. And so I did that and founded it on my own and got three of the big companies in the US to be founding members. And then we just started growing from there. And our mission was, you know, very different than NPA. NPA was all about lobbying. And I think one of the main reasons why it closed eventually was the fact that it was very hard to get anything done. You can't really, and this is something I preached over and over again. I said, we can't lobby the Chinese government. You can talk to them. They'll meet with us and they're happy to. We can have dinners with them. We can have all these things and have nice friendships. But at the end of the day, they're not going to listen to anything or actually implement pretty much anything we say. I was much more on the business side of, you know, how do we help members? What they really, really need is how can they do business in China and how, you know, what things can they do? Are their products right? You know, is the label right? Is the color of the box wrong? Or, you know, they just need real help. So that's where HBA China came in. I set it up more as a business consultancy nonprofit where our members could join our group. And we provide them again first with kind of regulatory. You know, we work with each member differently. Some companies come to us and they've already been in China for many, many years, but need help in other areas. And other companies are brand new, like a small or medium-sized company that's never been to China. And they need to know, step one, regulatory. What is it going to cost you or how can you enter the China market? And in some cases, that just doesn't work out. And they say, thank you very much for all the information. And they go on their way and, you know, go off to a different country to try to enter. And then we go and find partners. You know, we go through the whole list of things is, you know, if they can make entry, then we start looking for partners and we start talking to them about cross-border e-commerce. Then we start talking to them about marketing and helping them with that. And so there's a whole, you know, bunch of services. They're all business related. So that's kind of what HPA does. And it's a nonprofit 501c6. So it's not a charity. It's considered a business group or, you know, kind of chamber of commerce type situation for nonprofit. And the companies will pay one fee every year as a membership fee. And then they have access to, you know, all the services we offer.
A bit of a Sherpa for natural health products into China. It's so super important though.
When it's ingredients too, it's finished products. So products, you know, B2C. And then there's a lot of our business now more so is actually B2B. So we're dealing with ingredient manufacturers from all over the world that are trying to get in China, sell to Chinese manufacturers to create new products and new brands in China, you know, made by Chinese companies, but the ingredients are from Europe or America or, you know, wherever. So we work with a lot of ingredient companies as well.
Can you give our audience an overview of China's natural health products market?
Let me see if I can do this quickly. It's a long story. But so it started, I would say, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, some of the big multi-level marketing kind of direct sale companies entered China, like Amway and, you know, Herbalife and these type of companies. And that's typical. Most countries, and at that point, there wasn't very much of a dietary supplement industry in China. There were vitamins there, but they were all from pharmaceutical companies that had entered the market, like Pfizer or these big companies. They'd bring in, like here in America, probably people are familiar with Centrum. You know, Centrum multivitamin or Caltrate calcium supplement. These were all brought into China. There wasn't really any regulatory things on the books for supplements. So they all entered the market as OTC pharmaceutical products. And that was a bad thing for the industry, actually, because it trained consumers into thinking that vitamins are medicine. And that became a problem later down the road. But so those were the first kind of entry level groups, is first the pharma people, and they were just bringing in Centrum. They'd get it approved as a drug, an over the counter medicine, and it was sold in pharmacies as kind of like a multivitamin over the counter medicine. Then you get all the multi-level marketing companies coming in, because and they start laying the foundation. They start, you know, bringing in products and getting them registered and selling through the market. And that's, I think Amway is probably the first one, if I'm not mistaken. It was, I don't know, there was actually one more, Sunrider maybe, but they kind of started early on. And then companies like MBTY, I think, was one of the first big American brands to actually go over there. And prior to them, in between that multi-level marketing and MBTY, was a lot of Chinese companies that would open up a little tiny LLC in California somewhere. They'd get some supplements made in California, ship them over to China and sell them as American products, which in some cases they were made in America, but they weren't American brands. They were brands that no one, like I went to the pharmacy and I was seeing all these things with American flags on them. And in some cases there were some Canadian products with a Canadian flag on it, and to just show the consumer, hey, we're a foreign brand, you know, we're great. But I had never seen any of those brands ever in my life. And then after that came MBTY, then later GNC, and then some of the other, you know, international big brands started showing up in the market. But that's kind of the start of it. That's where it kind of started. And I got there right as that, as an MBTY person, that's where the big brands started showing up, is where I kind of landed. And Australia brands like Swiss and Blackmores and all these people were starting to look at the market and show up too.
I guess fast forward to today, you know, maybe a quick thought on where is the market in China when it comes to natural health products? Where are they at now? Whether just in like, you know, opinions, beliefs, you know, product differentiation, you know, why we know it's growing and we're going to get into that. I mean, we wouldn't be here talking about it if it wasn't such an important category, and growing at such a pace that it is right now. So, you know, we'll just obviously, you know, acknowledge that right off the top. But, you know, why, how, and what is the size of the market? Just a little bit more around that, because we are going to talk consumer trends. So we'll get into the nuts and bolts in a little bit. But just right now, where is that market today?
Well, I went through lots of, you know, coming out of that, once the big brands started showing up, moving forward, there's a good piece of maybe, you know, 8 years of people just starting to import products as food into China and not dietary supplements. The regulations are really what drove and hindered this industry. So at that time, there was just the beginnings of regulations coming out specific for supplements. And it got to the point where, you know, we can get into the regulatory part, I guess, later. But it got to the point where it's getting very, very difficult to import products into China. And that's where around 2014, that's where CrossBorder and Alibaba kind of created Tmall. And so, you know, when that doorway of exporting products to China as food started closing, the window of CrossBorder was opening almost at the same time. So the whole market started to shift from, you know, having a distributor in China, putting your product on the shelf in a super, like a high-end supermarket where a lot of expats or wealthy Chinese shop, you know, now is starting to shift over to the internet of these cross-border channels. And it was happening slowly, but it was, you know, happening over the years. Just kept growing and growing and growing to the point now where, you know, CrossBorder is the major channel where people buy these, you know, anything that's international brands or foreign to China is usually, you know, bought in that CrossBorder channel. Now you asked the size. I mean, the size of the market, I don't think anyone really knows. And you can ask, you know, I've asked, we have various sources to get this information, but some of it is the Chinese government that controls all the imports and exports. They have numbers. There's a Chinese Healthcare Association. They have their numbers. If you look at Euromonitor or any of the other big multinational companies that track sales and marketing around the world, they have their numbers, and they're skewed by billions of dollars. I mean, they're just not even close. The U.S. market, I believe, is approaching or in the $60 billion range, and China's number two. So U.S. is the biggest market for supplements in the world, and China has grown to the point where it became number two. And that's considering that it's not even, I mean, it's hasn't even put a dent in the potential of what China could be. For example, if China had regulations similar to the U.S. or even Canada, that market would be probably twice the size. It'd be huge. So it's always a guesstimate when you see someone say, oh, the China market supplement is worth this much. I don't really pay too much attention to that. I pay more attention to, you know, someone that's tracking the sales, the actual real sales figures and growth rates of products online. Then you can get a better sense of, you know, where does my product fit? What does my competition look like? And, you know, let's start, you know, working on a model to get in there. So I'm guessing the China market is probably worth maybe 40 billion, somewhere in there, 30, 40 billion, give or take. It's, you know, give or take 10 billion. I mean, that's huge, but it's very hard to put a number on it, but it is growing. And that's another important part is just look at, is it growing? And the only place you can really kind of track that is through access to cross-border numbers, because those don't lie. You can see exactly, if you have the back end, you can see what's being sold, how much of it, dollars, all that stuff. And you can start, you know, pumping out percentages and all these things.
So we may not know exactly how big, and we may not know exactly the rate of growth that it is experiencing, but what we do know for sure is that it is fast growing. So my question to you then is why?
The rate we can say, and that's only through cross-border channels, though. And cross-border, as we see it now, is outpacing brick and mortar for the first time in forever. But we do have double-digit growth. We can see that on cross-border. That overall, it's about a 20%, 23% growth rate still. And this has been constant. Now you compare that to the U.S. market, which is the biggest market, but we usually have a growth rate of anywhere from 3 to 5%, because the market is so developed. It's just not going to grow that much. You just want to make sure you see the U.S. market is positive, even if it's just 1 or 2%. But yeah, China's still growing. It's still going.
And why though? Why has it experienced so much growth? And I mean, I'll say this recently. I don't think we saw these rates of growth 10 years ago, but we've seen these rates of growth recently. Why?
Well, this industry is interesting because every market it does enter. So if you look at the underdeveloped markets, that would be a lot of the markets in Asia, a lot of the markets in Latin America that are now becoming developed and very large. China is unique out of that grouping in that China is two cultural things that China is known for is food and health. So Chinese grow up with Chinese medicine as part of their cultural heritage, which brings in, you know, grandma telling you this and mom or dad and, you know, passing along these things about, you know, and you live there. I'm sure you've heard these things like don't let a fan blow on you directly, you know, because, and all these things are tied to Chinese medicine.
Don't drink cold water.
Don't drink, you know, Chinese people drink warm or hot water.
I wasn't
water.
Even allowed to sit on a cold rock. I would have ice all over me saying, no, you shouldn't sit on that. You'll get hemorrhoids. Stand up.
Yeah. Yeah. Or walk around your house barefoot, earlier we were talking about our heat and stuff, and you walk around barefoot. Don't walk around barefoot in your house because the cold tile floors will create, cold chi. And so all these things were tied to Chinese medicine. And so that's a huge one. You know, when you're a pregnant lady in China, you know, there's special soups you need to drink, and there's protocols to follow. And these are all based on Chinese traditional medicine. So that's one thing, food and health. So health and nutrition are two big driving forces for China. And anytime something taps into that, it usually is successful, typically. So you see the recent boom in fitness in China. That when I got there, that was not the case. I actually had to lift. I've lifted weights in a 5-star hotel gym. That's the only gym I could get a handle at was that. And then after that, they started having fitness clubs. But even then, they were empty. I would just walk into these clubs and people were dumping all kinds of investment into these health clubs. And there would be like 50 treadmills with two people in the gym. And they would have multiple, I mean, really, really, really well-developed and impressive gyms that, I'd walk in and I had the run of the place, no problem. Now that's not the case. I mean, China has, you know, fitness, marathons, cycling, triathlons, Ironman type stuff. There's movies that have been, you know, have influenced this as well. The government has influenced this as well because the fact that the senior population in China is so big, that it's going to be a really big economic headache for China in the near future. There's just too many old people. They have an inverted kind of, pyramid for their growth. They have not enough kids, and that was all due to the one child policy. But the senior citizen rate is so much. So the government is trying their best to implement healthy living and trying to keep these senior citizens healthy, you know, because if they all turn 60 to 65, 70, and they all, you know, half of them get sick or get diseases, it's going to bankrupt the country.
Well, and they don't have 401ks, so.
No. So that's one area you're going to see if an industry does well or grows, you can usually point to government intervention. So the government's behind this push. But then again, back to the culture aspect, the people enjoy that. People welcome, you know, fitness. And there was a recent movie not too long ago, it was a boxing movie with a Chinese lady that I can't remember the name of it, but the movie is about her journey from being very overweight and obese, slimming down, getting fit, and actually becoming a boxer. And that was huge. That influence, you can look at the numbers online of people looking at things for weight loss, for, you know, stamina, energy, all these type of things to get in shape and get fit, and protein powders, these type of things. So there was a lot of kind of things in the culture and the country itself to kind of influence the growth of it. And then most recently, just to add that one last thing, is COVID. So COVID globally influenced a lot of people to buy supplements. So as soon as COVID hit and it started spreading in China initially before it came, you know, global, Chinese people start buying up any kind of supplements that were immune related. So anything that had some kind of, you know, this could help your immune system, boom, buy it. And that happened globally. I mean, people were just buying supplements everywhere. I think so. The two industries that really benefit a lot from COVID was, besides the pharma and all that stuff, was supplements, because people were buying more supplements. And IT industry, of course, because people were stuck at home and they were playing on all the apps, and all these apps grew out of nowhere. But COVID was a big push too. And then even prior to that was the, what was that, that other virus that China had? SARS back in the day.
Oh yeah. Way back. Yeah.
SARS hit off, I think grapeseed extract was something someone was bringing into China and saying it was good for your immune system. So we saw like huge, huge volumes of grapeseed extract being sold in China back during SARS.
To me, I think what the government can do, say, you know, something that culturally there was always a path to employment and wealth. You know, if you were to pursue sports, there was a lot of viable outcomes by being really healthy, being really athletic, and pursuing sports. And 20, 30, 40 years ago in China, there were not those obvious pathways. There was the pursuit of sports, health, athletics, didn't lead to anywhere. It was kind of like the way our parents thought of us when we said we wanted to be a musician when we grew up. And like, well, that's going to get you nowhere. And then, you know, maybe kind of on that kind of similar path with a focus on really kind of the health and of your finances and the stability of it, drove a lot of decision making and what parents were guiding their kids into wanting to go to university and what they were supposed to study and all these kinds of things. And so athletic sports, things like that, were not prioritized for sure. Now it's becoming more clear. It's becoming more of a direction. And I think just a different generation now who appreciates that stuff more. And so they are looking for supplements and things to help them be better or healthier and do well, whether it's their body or their performance at the sport or activity that they do.
Just to add on to that, since we're talking about sports. So, prior to me arriving in China, or even when I arrived in Greater China the first time in like 2000, there most Chinese that were doing if something that was considered a sport was not something that the rest of the world did as a sport. So they, ping pong,
badminton,
what is that called? Genti or Tiza, the little feather cock thing they kick around.
The hacky sack.
It had the feathers on it. It was a genti or something it was called. I forget. But anyways, so there's a lot of this type of stuff. None of my friends, I had lots of local friends. So again, as an expat, I was a little different than most expats. I had a lot of expat friends that were colleagues of mine. So people that worked in the U.S. Embassy or people that worked in the American Chamber, people I needed to work with for work. I mean, they're all nice people, but I chose to hang around with a lot of local people. I made a lot of local friends and I would go out and do a lot of local activities. So, playing, baseball, football, hockey, basketball, tennis, all these things you didn't see, exercising in terms of fitness, jogging, marathons, none of this stuff existed, riding your bike, triathlon, no one really did that stuff. That all came on very recent. And now if you go to China, it's bodybuilding, every sport you can imagine. Basketball got huge. The NBA had a big push in China, would show up to China. And that's a very big sport now in China. Tennis. I think the latest one now is the venture of Chinese athletes into the UFC. You can see the mixed martial arts and ultimate fighting. And so there's a lot of Chinese athletes starting to come up into that too. So you can pretty much find any sport you want that you like, with the exception of the NFL. NFL has tried to penetrate, but I think they're just talking with my Chinese friends. They always joke that they're like, no Chinese mother is ever going to let their son bash heads with another guy. It's too dangerous. So hockey and football, American football, you don't really see too much in China. Soccer, of course, or what the rest of the world calls football, is huge. I mean, it's a big one in China as well. But
non-contact sports
changed. Exactly. For the most part. Yeah.
Yeah, totally true. Wanted to ask you about the top subcategories. What are the top subcategories? Also, maybe the health issues that maybe the upper echelons of the government or the decision makers there are seeing, health issues that they are seeing. There's health issues that the public is aware of that's going to drive consumption growth. And then there's, like you said, that inverted population kind of graphic where an overabundance of population growing older and older and older, and what the government is potentially seeing as potential issues coming down the road, and what kind of health issues those might be. Those two things may not be as correlated as I had hoped when I started that. So, you may have to separate one from the other. So top subcategories and then health issues driving the consumption.
Yeah. So the categories of products your question is, right? So China, I think globally everything is fairly similar. So a lot of brands are, global brands, and they, push a certain product for a certain reason and it becomes globally acceptable. And that's kind of what follows in suit. But, the U.S. market is always going to be kind of the first of the leader because the regulatory environment is pretty open here. And you're going to get those things popping up quickly. But just following along with the fitness stuff, so anything that's involved with fitness is growing right now very rapidly. So those are protein powders and creatine and things for, sports performance, energy, weight loss. That whole sports nutrition category is fairly large. Probiotics became very, very big in China. And that's because they were, you know, probiotics for the most part, there's a lot of research that, and probiotics are amazing and do all kinds of things. It's prebiotics, probiotics, postbiotics, there's all kinds of stuff. But immune system and digestion are kind of the two key structure function type claims that probiotics fit under. And again, that's, you know, the COVID thing that happened, you know, people were looking for immune system products. So probiotics are starting to flatten out now. They were growing like crazy fast, and they're still growing, but not as fast as before. I think the initial products that got popular in China were multivitamins, calcium, and then later fish oil or omega-3. Those are all still well known and popular. Calcium is still a very highly sought after purchased product. The only thing that happens sometimes is the function of the product, like what does it do, is not well understood or misrepresented by the people presenting it to China. So in the case of calcium, people typically take calcium in the US. Women normally are the big consumers of that to protect their bone health, especially as they get older. That would be number one for sure. The very rarely do you see men just popping calcium if they're, you know, younger or 30, 40 year olds. It's usually when gentlemen get older and they need more calcium in their diet. In China, it was those two as well, but it was also kids. And it was portrayed that if kids took calcium, they'd grow taller. And that was something that was pushed in the market. And a lot of moms were like, oh, I want my kid to be, you know, tall. I want him to be 6 foot. I mean, that's great. Let's buy calcium and get my kid to be tall. So sometimes those things happen in the market. And China tries to do a good job of trying to, you know, squash that. But it's hard with a country of that size. But that's kind of it. I mean, they all the things that are popular here are also pretty much popular there. It just takes a little bit longer to get there.
I'm inspired to ask about, let me put it this way, without giving away too much of my opinion of how Western countries do or don't do this well. How well does China protect its citizens from misinformation and false advertising and bad ingredients and all of these things? How well does China do to make sure that what's being understood about products, the fads, the trends are somewhat accurate, and that the products available for purchase are of good quality?
You know, overall, they do it to some degree as well as Western company or countries. The fact, though, is that it is, you know, tenfold in terms of population size and being able to control. And then China, you know, has provinces, and the difference, I think the main difference between China and, say, like the US, for example, is that each province is like its own little kingdom, and they will interpret regulations and laws based on their understandings or their, you know, to give them a benefit, perhaps. So as a foreign or international company trying to get into China, when you're trying to, this comes into play when you're trying to import into China, different ports of entry are going to give you different problems. And it's, well, isn't it the same country? Why are the laws? Why, if I go to this port, they won't let me in, but this port says, come on in, no problem. You know, so there's that issue. And then there's the regulations. The regulations are very strict, and in fact, cause or force a lot of companies to play in that guerrilla marketing environment and, you know, kind of putting a toe over the line sometimes to try to get these products to the consumer. So for example, if a new product is comes out in America here, and it's got some new ingredients that were just, you know, approved or have GRAS status in America, and you can actually put them in a supplement and sell them in America, and it's a really good product, you know, someone's going to want to take that to China immediately because it's going to sell well there too. But the ingredients in there are all new. Nobody knows what those things are in China. And in America, we have the ability to kind of market those and structure function claims and tell people, here's this new product. This one ingredient is this, and it's from that, and it's been found to do this. this ingredient that's in there is this, blah, 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 blah. And you can go over the ingredient list, however many ingredients in there, kind of marketing to the consumer and tell them. You can't say it cures cancer. You can't say it treats or cures heart disease. You know, so these are all US laws. You can't say that, but you can at least say this product will help, you know, the cardiovascular system. So it doesn't exactly say what it cures or treats, but it says it's beneficial to this system. And that at least gives the message to the consumer that, hey, you know, I think my dad's had heart attacks and my family's got a lot of heart disease in it. You know, maybe I should take something that's good for my cardiovascular system. You know, in China, we don't have that unless you get, you know, the product approved, which costs a lot of money. We haven't gone through that yet, but that's one of the, you know, kind of hoops you got to jump through of fire to get your products in the market. So if you bring your product into the market and you can't advertise it to the consumer, you know, what do you do? So a lot of companies, especially if they're Chinese companies, they know they can cross that line, say a bunch of stuff to get sales, run back on the other side of that line and hope they don't get caught. But eventually they do. But in the meantime, they've made a bunch of money and they can just, you know, pay a fine and walk away or whatever. So it's a lot of times it's the regulatory environment that encourages people to kind of cheat or kind of mislead, if you will, the consumers, which is unfortunate, but just the way it is.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, you know, next question really was, what are those key regulatory challenges for overseas brands trying to crack into the China market?
Yeah, so there's two. When I start talking to a company, consulting them from square one here is regulatory, as I mentioned before. So there's two ways to get into the market. One would be your traditional commerce, and the other way would be through cross-border. Cross-border, of course, we can talk a little bit later, but it's got a lot of other ways to do it. But the major way would be I want to ship pallet loads of my product to China and then get it on the shelf and sell it to consumers. Well, first you need the product to be registered by the government and get what is called, in Chinese, they have this saying, and we just translate it into English, which is called blue hat. And there's a little logo that gets printed on the bottle. Once you get the bottle or the product registered, the logo looks like a little blue crown or a little blue hat. So that's why they call it a blue hat. It's just a kind of funny name. But you need to get that for your product. And that will, you can... This would take a whole nother hour to go over all this, but I'll try to keep it pretty basic. So this registration can take anywhere from 2 to 5 years to complete. There's toxicology testing, all kinds of testing that needs to be done. And then there's a list of claims that you can put on your product. So some of those claims require human trials. Some of them require animal testing. And so this is a very long process. Normally it's 3 to 4 years and it can cost about $150,000 to $200,000 US for one product. So that's that right there is usually, the company puts the car in reverse and starts backing up and they're like, nah, it's a little bit too rich for our blood because, you're jumping into market. You don't know if your product's going to do well. You're going to invest 3 or 4 years of your time and $200,000, you know, and then it might not work. So that's a huge hurdle is just to get the product in the country, get it approved and get it on the shelves. So cross-border, came around, as I mentioned before, Alibaba and Tmall kind of started that whole thing. And since then, there's, you know, JD and Pinduoduo and, you know, all kinds of different social media platforms. You can sell your products through cross-border. And to keep it simple, that, again, is a product made in America, Canada, or anywhere else in the world. And it's sold in China through the cross-border platform or a server that is typically like in Hong Kong or something like that. And it's a product that the way the government looks at it basically is like a Chinese person flies over to America as a tourist. They walk into a GNC store and they buy a bottle of fish oil off the shelf or 10 bottles of fish oil, put it in their luggage and bring it home. The only thing they're required to do in customs, they're not going to say, oh, you can't, that's not registered. You can't bring that in the country. You would be required to pay the tax, import tax on those products. Now, in all the years I lived in China, no one ever went through and declared anything. I never saw anybody going through and declaring anything in China. So China was losing lots of money, taxes over all kinds of different products. So when this cross-border thing happened, the government, I think, really initially liked it because it automatically taxed everything. So if you're going to buy a bottle of fish oil on this cross-border platform in China, that product's going to be sent to the consumer either from the country of origin directly, which would take quite a long time, or it's being held in a bonded warehouse in China and can be shipped to them and clear customs through the bonded warehouse and get to their house within, you know, 1 to 3 days. But in both cases, they're going to pay a small tax on that, you know, product. So the government gets their money. And now consumers have access to foreign products that they never had before. And you don't need to register the products. That's the key. The cross-border system, you do not have to register anything as long as it's being sold in the country of origin and it's been in that market for at least a year, you can sell it in China, no problem, through that cross-border system.
Now, last question. Can you tell us how cross-border e-commerce works for brands in this market, why brands should be eyeing this market entry channel in order to enter China?
So that kind of picks up right where I left off. And that's a fact that, you know, that first thing when I talk to a company about entering China, going the commercial route, the traditional way is very expensive, both in time and money. And a lot of companies just like, wow, that's a lot. And we have like 35 products we want to bring to market. So it's like 35 times $200,000. So cross-border, again, no registration. You don't need it. Where the expenses come in is where, like, how are you approaching the market? Do you want to tiptoe into the shallow end of cross-border? Or do you want to jump, you know, cannonball it into the deep end and go for it? And also, how much of your destiny do you want to control? Do you want to open an office in China and have a team on the ground to oversee all this and actually do, you know, have marketing people and all that? So there's various ways to, you know, handle a cross-border business from a company's perspective. That the least expensive way and the tiptoe way would be to work with like Tmall. They have a portion of their website that is for small companies that are not in China, that have never been in China, and they can kind of highlight your products online and you can send the products to them and they have a warehouse in California. And I'm just speaking about America. This is, you know, true for other parts of the world as well, but I'm not familiar with where their warehouses are, any of that stuff. And you can try to work with Tmall directly, which is owned by Alibaba. And that's a very kind of least risky way, where if it doesn't work and you're not seeing any sales, you've sent Tmall, maybe they'll ask you for 20 bottles or 30 bottles just to stick on the shelf in California and they'll ship out from there. So it's not very risky and it might be a good way for some companies just to try, but that's never going to make anyone rich doing that. That's just basically to kind of test the waters and see if your product can move. And then you start to turn the dial up and you go to the next step. And if you see that your product is actually has a good potential to move, then you know, if you're not going to open an office in China, then you probably definitely want to get involved with an agency or someone that controls, you know, that can help you build out a Tmall flagship store or build out your platform inside Tmall, help with marketing, help with all the different sales that happen in China. Is, you know, annually there's different times where prices go, you know, like a Black Friday here. They have November 11th and there's 6/8/1. They have all a bunch of different, you know, holiday channels. So there's a variety of agencies and quite a few of them are foreign owned. And have, you know, people that can, you know, speak English and all that and help you through that. Of course, they charge a fee every month, you know, to work with them. And then they take usually a percentage of your sale as a commission. But they can, you know, get you to that next level because they're going to really help position you better. They're going to help with marketing. And that becomes a much bigger investment because you're going to be paying a monthly fee to this company, percentage of sales, and you'll have to have, you know, some kind of upfront decent marketing budget to kind of explode yourself onto the scene and push it out over, you know, six months to 12 months is the kind of critical time you really need to work hard and punch through there and get things moving. So you get what you pay for, you know. So if you put a lot of investment into your cross-border platform and you make a nice platform and you put your position yourself on different platforms and social media and use key opinion leaders like influencers, they can really help you move a lot of product. But it's, you know, you're going to have to invest some money up front for sure.
Jeff Crowther, Executive Director of the Health Products Association China. Thank you very, very much for coming on the show today. We really appreciate your time and your insights.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
For everybody watching on the YouTube channel and you need audio only, don't forget that we are live on all your favorite podcast platforms. If you want to just search up the show, The Negotiation. If you're listening to us audio and you want to see us in video, feel free to head over and find the WPIC YouTube channel where all the videos live. If you want to get in touch with us, if you have a guest suggestion or just some feedback for us, feel free to send us an email to podcast@WPIC.co. But from me, from Jeff, and for everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening and or watching. We'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@WPIC.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.